Welcome to In Our Mom's Basement Video Game Podcast, where we talk about everything video games with your host, Dan Giofue and Rage Quit Pat.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to episode 64 of In Our Mom's Basement Podcast, the first podcast of 2021. I'm Rage Quit Pat. Dan, the pizza man, you're here. How are you?
Yeah, man, I'm good, man. I've just been packing all day for the move tomorrow morning, so I've been pretty beat.
Oh, all right. Well, I thought you were, I'm glad. Are you feeling better?
Yeah, I'm ready to take a shower, though, so after this, I'm going to jump in there.
All right, perfect. All right, well, Dan the Pizza Man is feeling much better, so here he is. I am joined by my wonderful co-host, the lover of all pizza, Dan the Pizza Man. And today, guys, we have our guest, our first guest of 2021. Very honored to have him here, entering the Gamer Cave here. And this guest here, really quickly, he couple fun facts. Began training in Taekwondo at 7 years old and became an ATA world champion in his early teens. And since then, he has studied a myriad of martial arts, including fencing and archery, and will be a lifelong student of combat sports. It was not long after he started martial arts that our guest discovered his love for theater. And also, our esteemed guest here eventually moved from New York to Los Angeles to pursue a career in entertainment industry, where he met his wife, Desi Ray, and shortly after, they have one child, Katana. And our wonderful guest here that is joining us on the Gamer Cave, he is the voice of Ryo Hazuki from the Shenmue series. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Corey Marshall to the Gamer Cave. Corey, how are you? And welcome to the Gamer Cave.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, I am excellent. And thank you for having me as your first guest of 2021. I appreciate that. I'm honored. Thank you.
No, absolutely. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We are huge fans of the Shenmue series here. And we are very, again, very honored to have you. And, you know, let's get started with the questions. What questions do we have for Corey first?
Oh, let's start when you were younger. What are some of the your favorite games when growing up?
Oh man, favorite games growing up. Let's see. oh, my daughter just came into the room. Oh, she's got treats for me. Well, I mean, I was lucky. I got a chance to experience early systems. I mean, even my brother had an Atari. So I would sneak into his room and play Atari when he wasn't home, when he was at school or something like that. And I got a chance to play all those old classics. And, you know, I think the first system that I was given by my mother was the NES. So, yeah, I remember playing, you know, Mario and all that kind of stuff. But I think probably my favorite game there was probably Zelda. And Zelda's a great series even to this day. Me and, in fact, my daughter, who just came in here, 11 years old, we actually played Breath of the Wild currently right now. And so Zelda's got to be one of my all-time classics for, you know, back in the day. And then with the Super NES, I think it's got to be, for us here in the States, it was Final Fantasy III. And that's got to be, man, that's got to be one of my all-time favorite games. Me and my friend played that game forever. We played it. It was one of those first times that I ever took a game and just played it so long, it was ridiculous. We got all of our characters up to level 99. All of our strikes were 9,999. You know what I mean? Like, we wanted to get all the gear, all the, you know what I mean? We wanted to make sure we were in God level before we went on and faced Kefka, which is Kefka, which is the final boss in that one. And that is one of those games that was, and it means so much to me because of, yeah, like me and my friend just spending hours and hours and hours on it. So that one has very deep meaning for me.
That's awesome. And we're huge fans of, are you going to, I know you mentioned you and your daughter were playing Breath of the Wild. Are you going to go back to the N64 days and maybe boot up Ocarina of Time?
that'd be great. So many people, when I've mentioned Zelda, me playing Zelda way back in the day, so many people are like, oh my God, have you played Ocarina of Time? Have you played, what is it? Wind,
Wind Waker.
Wind Waker is another one that a friend has recommended. It's one of his favorite games. And I feel like because there was a large chunk of Zelda games that I didn't get a chance to participate in. You're right. I kind of feel like, oh man, I want to make sure that I experience these because I only got a chance to play the first two. Well, not chronologically, but I guess as they came out, you know, only got a chance to play the first two. So there's a whole bunch that I'm missing because I went from one and two all the way down to Breath of the Wild, and we're going to be getting obviously Age of Calamity here pretty soon, Breath of the Wild too. But I feel the pain when people start to talk about these games and how much they love it and how much it means to them. I'm like, oh God, I gotta do it.
Yeah, Ocarina of Time is, I'm not the biggest Zelda fan. I prefer to watch people play it rather than me play it. But okay. I know Dan the Pizza Man is a big, huge Zelda fan. but for me,
I got Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, N64. I still got those, but I play Breath of the Wilds. But I mean, as good as a game was, I don't know. It's just not a game I was able to get into.
Which one, Breath of the Wild or
Breath of the Wild? Yeah, the one on Switch.
Okay, yeah, me and my daughter enjoy the Switch a lot, and I think it's just because of the portability. You know what I mean? Katana takes it with her all the time whenever we go on a long trip in the car or something like that. Los Angeles, anything that's more than 10 miles is a long trip because of traffic. You're going to be, in traffic for about an hour. You could almost walk there faster, but we could just sit in the car and play Breath of the Wild instead. So,
that's Switch is great for that. I do love the Switch.
Yeah, the Switch is an awesome system. Nintendo definitely rebounded. Corey, when did you decide, when did you get into voice acting? When did that journey begin?
Yeah, as you mentioned before, I was in New York at the time. Actually, I was attending college out there. And I saw an advertisement for voiceover audition, and it was like 2 to 3 months in Japan doing voiceover for a major game company or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it said. It was actually a very small little snippet, a little article, tiny little box that had the ad in it. And it's great that my eyes didn't glance over it, because it's probably easy to miss, And I had done all kinds of stuff before. I'm a longtime actor since I was a kid. I started doing stage, and then I did TV and film, and just everything that you can think of, and even modeling and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, I love video games. You know what I mean? And I love Japanese animation and all that kind of stuff. And I said, I've never done this before, but I kind of feel like I could take all of my previous acting experience and everything that I've done before and, translate that into something that I really love. And let's just go for it and see what happens. You know what I mean? So I kind of like stupidly didn't know what I was doing and just kind of went in for the audition anyway, just to see what would happen. And if I tanked, then I tanked. And if I got it, then okay, then we'll see where this takes us. And it was Shenmue was my very first voiceover audition, and I ended up getting it. You know what I mean?
Oh, wow.
Like I said, I just kind of like boldly went into it just to see what would happen. And it happened to be Shenmue.
Wow. So it was Shenmue. I thought maybe there was previous games before that, but Shenmue was your very first. Wow.
That's correct. So this is my very first jump into any voiceover realm at all, because even when I had done, after I had done Shenmue, I came back to New York and there was a company there doing dubs, and I had done Japanese animation after that. So all the voiceover work that I did so far has actually been after Shenmue, you know what I mean? Shenmue 1's the very first voiceover that I ever did. Like I said, I kind of just went for it to see what would happen, and here we are talking about it today.
Yeah, that's awesome. That is again, very, very beloved series. And did, at the time, did you know how popular it ended up becoming?
You know, no. So I wasn't aware of Shenmue, first of all, when they didn't tell us what the project was. Later on, after the audition, I found out that I was going to be working for Sega, which was great because I was like, oh my God, you know, it's like,
yeah, well, yeah,
you know, one of the greatest, game creators of all time, right? I was unaware of the project, and when it's kind of like, I don't know, they kind of told me a little bit during the audition, a little bit about the character and a little bit about the story to kind of help me understand, who he is and all that kind of stuff, so I could create a character during the audition. But they literally didn't tell me anything about it until I got there. So I was going into Japan not knowing what I was doing, not knowing the name of the project, not knowing, anything, not even what the character looked like or where it was going to be taking place. Or I literally found out everything about Shenmue when I got there. They brought me in. They showed me, just tables and tables and tables of, they had these big offices, you know what I mean? Like computers, but Japanese use a lot of paper, so they had these big binders and stuff with all the different characters in it. And I mean everything, not just the main characters, but every street vendor has a name, has a short tidbit about their personality or about their personal story, and it even has their blood type, has their birth date. You know, it's like I remember looking at this stuff and flipping through the books and being like, what? I mean, street vendor who sells, whatever. It doesn't matter if it's flowers or hot dogs or whatever. They all had. Well, I guess those are some more main characters. But even like grocery store people, it's like they had information about who they were. And I was like, God, I've never seen anything like this before. You know, like, why? Why would you put store owner number 15, why would you have his blood type? Why would you have, why would you have his birth date? I was like, God, that's crazy. The amount of detail that they went into. Of course, they had their picture right by it as well. Like it was, almost like a passport photo or something like that, you know? So, I was really surprised of all the wealth of information that they presented to me when I got there. So yeah, I didn't know anything about it going in, but seeing all that stuff there, they let me know everything. You know, they even played some music for me. They of course talked about the storyline that we were going to be doing in Shenmue 1, but even I remember they even showed me reference photos that they had taken. They said, "Oh yeah, we went to these particular parts in Japan because it's this small town in Japan, Yokosuka, and we went there to take photographs, and there were buildings that were built around that time, and there's a bridge there and this and that." And they actually showed me photos that they had a whole team of people go there and take all these reference photos and make all these notes, and talking about street layout and everything. It was incredible. And that's the first time, we're talking 20 years ago, that's the first time that I had ever even heard of anything like that, you know what I mean? I was really surprised after I had gotten there and received all this information.
Well, that sounds like a fun time though.
A 19 20 year old kid to go to Japan for the first time and to see all this and realize, like, wow, holy shit, I get to be a part of something like this. I just knew it was one of those things. Again, I didn't know exactly how it was going to end up or how or what it was at the time or anything like that. But when I got there, I just knew. I was like, oh man, this is it. This is what I've always wanted to do. This is, and I'm here experiencing it.
Yeah. Well, being in Japan, have you got to do anything fun over there? Interesting views or, eat a lot of different kinds of food.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. And it was great there too, because a lot of the, The people that I had just met, I mean, just people who worked in, because when I first lived there, they set me up in a hotel. So even just the people who worked in the hotel, people who were my age, of course, I started to befriend local people around the area where I lived. I had befriended them too. So it's, I got all these Japanese friends, and they took me to their favorite places and all that kind of stuff. But after that, we did have time, you know, for example, when they had to, they took a lot of my, all the work that we had done. A lot of times there's something called pickups, or where basically we work for a while, and then they go through everything and they realize like, oh, we messed up there, or oh, there was a sound there that we didn't catch, so we have to redo that one, or oh, we had the wrong text there, we changed that text because this makes more sense, or we changed the story or whatever, the translation was wrong, so we have to do some pickup lines. So there would be a time that I had like a whole week off. So I would go to, you know, Kyoto or something like that. I would take the train, take the bullet train down to Kyoto, enjoy the city for a few days, go back. There's even a time where I went up into the mountains, up into a place called Nikko. I mean, just beautiful mountainscapes with all these waterfalls and all these old temples. And yeah, I definitely took advantage as much as I possibly could while I was there, because I didn't know if I was coming back, you know. I just figured like, hey, I'll live it up when I can. I'm making decent money, and I'll just travel as much as I can, see as much as I can, be with as many people as I can, and just experience this wonderful place to its fullest. And yeah, I was very lucky. I met some really great people who were very friendly and showed me a lot of Japan. It was great.
Yeah, man. You know, Japan is definitely on one of my travel lists, since I've been doing a lot of traveling lately. And, you know, Japan is definitely one of those spots where I really want to go. I mean, it looks beautiful, man. And the food, you know, yeah. I know a lot of people went there. They said the food was absolutely amazing.
It is. You know, it depends on where you go, obviously. Japan, it's interesting that Japan is such a small place. If you think about it, even to the size of California. You know what I mean? Japan's a relatively small place, but every place that you go, every town, every prefecture, or you know, the islands down in the south or up north, or they have a very it's of course Japanese. It's distinctly Japanese, but they have their own culture, they have their own language sometimes, and they have their own food. So you could get the same dish. Let's just say you like some sort of soup dish, some sort of, you know, ramen type dish that you really enjoy. If you can get on a train and then go to another city, and their specialty there is, oh, well, we live next to the coast on this side, and we have a particular fish that we like to use. And so their fish goes in there, and then they're like, oh, well, we like to use, you know, a miso broth or whatever. And then you go further south, and then like, oh, well, we use a different fish, or we have coconuts here, so we use coconut milk. And you're like, oh, okay, I thought this was ramen. I'm like, oh yeah, it is, but you know, it's just our specialty, it's how we do it. So it's cool that everywhere you go, they all have their own sort of specialties, so you get to really experience a particular area, not by just their people and culture and their I guess their you know, landscapes and buildings and all that kind of stuff, but you really get to experience through food as well. And it's I think it's interesting that I kind of feel like I can go to 50 states here in the United States and get basically the same type of food, you know what I mean? California, it's like I kind of feel like places that are big hubs like New York or Los Angeles or, you know, Seattle or something like that, we get a great fusion of food, which is I really enjoy. But Japan is like, it's Japanese food, but it's all, you know, specialized for their particular district, prefecture, or whatever. And I find that fascinating. I love that about Japan.
Yeah, man, I'm a big ramen fan, so When I go okay, there, well, that's all I'm going to do, man.
You could go on a ramen tour and just experience everything from, you know, Hokkaido all the way down to Okinawa. Enjoy.
It seems like you had an amazing time in Japan. Also, besides your time in Japan, how was it meeting Yu Suzuki for the first time? How was that experience?
Well, I remember, you know, it's funny. Now that I've known Yu Suzuki for quite a while, he's very warm and friendly, and he's just very down to earth. Everything that I've ever known about him, he's like a dad. You know what I mean? He's such a great, cool guy that you feel comfortable around. But the first time that I met him was, of course, during Shenmue 1. We were kind of just getting settled on. We had even started recording already. And they said, oh, you know, Yu Suzuki's in the building. Would you, you know, he just came in. Would you like to meet him? And I was like, oh, sure. Yeah, I'd like to meet him. But of course, I'm like, oh, my God. Yes. I'm being all cash on the outside, but, you know, screaming on the inside. So, yeah, we went up a couple of floors. There's a whole crowd of people around him because, you know, I think, you know, what it is that when somebody is important, you know, when they're a director or a creator or something like that, it's the Japanese are very much about respect and very much about seniority and very much about, you know, it's just ingrained into their culture. So there's, and it's not even like something that he wants, I don't think. I think there's just an entourage of people who show up and everybody's like, you know, very respectful and bowing and very like quiet and solemn and, you know, very respectful and treating him like a demigod and everything, and which is totally understandable. But when I met him, he's just so warm. You know, he's not like a movie star or anything like that. He's one of those guys that you just want to hang out with because you just feel so happy around him. You know what I mean? I feel like because I've known him for a while now, I've kind of opened up to him a bit. And I remember thinking to myself, even people here in the States when they meet him, you know, they immediately switch on the Japanese respect, and they bow to him and they hand him the business card just like a Japanese person would. And you know, that just kind of happens, and I think he's used to that. But I don't think that's I don't think that's his thing. You know, I remember I was just thinking to myself, I'm like, I don't see that in him. I kind of feel like, I don't know. I'm going to see what happens and just going to be more casual around him, you know, and we'll see what happens. And I remember when we were there, he was like, oh, could we get a pic? Yu Suzuki asked, could we get a picture, you and me? And I looked at him and I was like, no. and he looked at me for a second and I smiled at him and he just started laughing, you know, because I was thinking probably nobody has ever told him no ever. Since he's been 5 years old, you know, he's probably never heard the word no. So I just decided to see what would happen. And he was like, you want to get a picture? No. And he gave me that look like, what?
Excuse me. Excuse me, sir. No one's ever said no to me.
But then he opened up, you know, and he laughed. And, you know, he put his arm around me and everything. And I was like, yeah, he's just a cool guy. He's a really... you know, cool guy is how I put it. But what it is too is that I know when he talks about Shenmue, you know, we've talked about it before in the past. We've talked about Shenmue 3 and Shenmue Legacy and where it's going and all that. He gets really, I can tell there's a gleam in his eye when he talks about Shenmue. You know, it's more than just a job. It really is a passion for him. He really does love what he's created. He puts all of his time and effort, not just for a paycheck. He really loves what he does, and he puts all of himself into it, all of his energy. And you can tell when he talks about it. It's funny when we're talking about Shenmue 3, I remember it's almost like he's talking about one of his kids, you know, and he's so proud of his kid. I mean, I don't know. He's never talked to me about his kids going to soccer practice for for an American reference, but I just kind of got this like feeling, like, oh man, he really, you know, this is like his magnum opus, you know, this is where he's put all of his passion, all of his effort into. Yeah, so that's how he approaches Shenmue as well. It's something that he lives, breathes. He's putting himself out there for us to enjoy.
I mean, you could definitely tell. I mean, when I remember playing the first game, it was ahead of its time. I don't, you know, remember a game being that ambitious,
right,
at the time. And that's what gravitated me towards the Dreamcast. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Dreamcast itself was a console that was ahead of its time. It felt like having an arcade in your own home. But yeah, when I played Shenmue, I couldn't really remember a game that was like a linear open world-ish type town where you literally could just, you know, you could go to the store and buy a bag of chips. You couldn't eat them, but it was just like, I don't know. I could buy a bag of chips or, you know, the cat in the game, you could feed the cat. Like, it's kind of like a little small portion of a cat simulator, taking care of a cat. And then just kind of going up to everybody and being like, hey, hello, did you see the black car that day?
Right.
And then just
even asking people, how's it going? You know, how's your shop? How's your, you know, what's going on? And people tell them their life story.
Yeah, it was funny. Like when you're not doing anything story wise, you literally, you go to people, be like, hey, how's business? And they're like, oh, well, business is all right. You know, all my customers have slowed down. And then what I would do on purpose in Shenmue was I would wait till Christmas, and then you would have Santa Claus walking up
the street. Right.
And then like it was, you know, you could tell he put a lot into part, you know, all the games. I mean, it was just a very ambitious game and I loved it. I mean, I still love it to this day. And then, you know, speaking of that, what I wanted to jump into as well is what was it that you loved about the Ryo Hazuki character?
Yeah. And
what have you seen in his growth the past three games besides his attractiveness? Apparently has definitely gone better, because I've noticed in the other games he's getting hit on more and more and more. So besides that, what has how has his growth been for you? You know, the past.
It's his gravitas that people are starting to be attracted to. They're like, oh, this guy has seen some, you know, he's seen some shit. He's like, he's really, yeah, he's like a man. He's young, but he's a man.
So just like Shenmue 3, you get hit on like left and right in Shenmue 3. It's like, oh, you're really cute. We should hang out.
So, you know, one thing that I've always loved about Hazuki is how disciplined he is and how driven he is. And that's why I, you know, they talked about, even just during the audition, they talked about who he was. You know, his father is a great martial arts teacher, has passed down his style to his son. And I kind of started to imagine just that, you know what I mean? A very disciplined, you know, young martial artist who has a focus, you know? And that's something that I admire about him, how it's like, you know, he jumps, you kind of feel like he's one of the characters that jumps into danger head first, you know, headlong into danger without looking, you know what I mean? Yeah. He's kind of like, he is the tip of the spear, you know? He is the one that's going to go in there, jump in there, do what's right, no matter what, no matter the danger, no matter how crazy it is. It doesn't matter if it's a 70-man fight or if it's a gigantic, you know, 400-pound giant, you know, Don Yu, or a killer that may be into some sort of metaphysical, magical, you know, mirrors, and who can literally pick you up with one hand. It doesn't matter who it is. He's going straight in because that's the right thing to do. He's going to stop evil people. He's going to rescue Nozomi. It does, you know, he just does it. And a lot of people in the story tell him that he's stupid. Like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you're going to kill yourself. That's crazy. Don't do that. But he doesn't let that stop him. So, you know, there's always that fine line between stupidity and bravery. And I guess the difference is success and failure, right? Like, if he were to go into a 70-man fight and die, people would be like, oh, yeah, he was dumb. But you know what I mean? Hazuki just knows he's going to win. He just, it's like Musashi, right? Musashi says, when you can defeat 10 opponents, it's the same thing as 100 being able to defeat 1,000. So he knows going into a battle that he's going to win, you know? And if he fails, gets up, brushes himself off, learns some new kung fu moves, and comes back and beats him again, you know? So he has that innate knowledge that, or instinct, really, I guess I should say, that that nothing's going to stop him from doing what he thinks is right. And he has a strong moral compass. That's something that I've really loved about Hazuki, his character, and how he has decided to define his life. And how he has changed over time. You know, I really do feel that his life ended that day. It was his birthday, the day that the rain turned to snow, the black car, the day his dad died, was murdered. I really do believe that his old self died there. He gave up everything. He gave up his family, what was left, you know, Ine-san and Fukuhara-san, who, you know, they're close enough to be considered family members, right? He leaves his home behind. He leaves probably somebody who was supposed to be his wife, maybe in the future. You know, it's kind of like, I think probably people were assuming that Nozomi and Hazuki would be together, and he left his town. He left everything behind to go on this mission, right? But then his story is all about what him realizing what's important. We hear this same theme over and over again. It's family and friends. Those are the things that he needs to keep close to him. And Iwao talks about that in the beginning of the story. So he has put up this huge wall and he's on this track and he's going to go there. He's going to get his revenge no matter what. But then as he goes along this journey, he meets people. He discovers, you know, other places, other lands. But then he realizes that all these people who come into his life are the things that are most important. You know, it doesn't matter if it's the old kung fu master in the park who's teaching him the iron palm, or if it's the young girl in the street when she takes care of the cat. He realizes that we all need to be together. I'm not, you know, you can't be just one person. What is making him more whole on his journey is everybody else. Right. So that is him. He's going on this journey of discovery that he needs to let more people in his life, whether that be Shenhua or he needs to have more friends, more mentors, you know, more people in his life that are going to, that's what's going to fill this hole, you know, this void that's now within him. So that's a theme that we see over and over and over again in Shenmue, and I really hope that a lot of people pick up on that and realize that family and friends are the most important thing. It doesn't matter, you know, your house could burn down, you could wake up tomorrow and your school could be destroyed. You know, it's like none of that stuff matters. It's just your loved ones that matter the most, and we see that. And I appreciate that. And that's the journey that I identify with a lot when I see Hazuki. He's becoming whole again. You know what I mean? he's becoming a person again, and it's slowly happening. But we can see even in Shenmue 3 that he's opening up more to Shenhua, and he talks about, you know, she talks about her family and her village and her father and all that kind of stuff. So he's absorbing that, and he's becoming a person again. He's becoming whole. That's what I see this journey of him going on. There is this outline story of adventure and revenge, but I think it's more, it's the story of somebody who's lost everything and is now becoming whole again. That's what I see, Shenmue.
Yeah, I kind of picked up on it towards the end of Shenmue 1 when Nozomi got kidnapped, and then you kind of see him like, oh my God, like all worried and stuff like that. The growth, it's definitely what you're saying with family and friends. Hazuki seems to be opening up a lot more than, you know, in the beginning of the game, and as it gravitated on more hours into the game, he started to open up a lot more and, you know, everything like that. But the determination is still there to one day get Lan D.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, that's still that drive and that determination that I talked about, his focus. That's something that still propels him on this journey. So yeah, that's what's gonna get us there, right? His determination.
And before we get to the next question, we have Corey Marshall here on the Inner Mom's Basement podcast. We're just gonna take a quick break for our sponsors, and we'll be right back. Well, thank you for that, our sponsor there. And again, Inner Mom's Basement, our first podcast of 2021. We have Corey Marshall here, the voice of Ryo Hazuki. And what is the next question we have for Corey?
Yeah, so yeah, actually, I've seen you've been doing some streaming, Shenmue and stuff. I want to, how are your streams going? You know, you get to meet a lot of people from that Shenmue community.
I do. So it goes like this. I didn't know if streaming would be a thing for me, you know. The thing is, I've had a lot of fans ask me to stream. They said, do you stream? You should stream. Why don't you stream? So I was like, I mean, I don't know. I didn't know if people would be into it. I kind of figured, well, maybe people would enjoy seeing me stream. Maybe they would, maybe they would. But I just had enough people ask me, and I said, okay, fine. I think I need to do this. So I set myself up. I started streaming. I'm just streaming on the PS4 right now. Nothing too fancy. And I got actually a really large response, and I really enjoy it. I like playing. So I'm playing Shenmue right now. I'm also playing Yakuza. Probably continue playing some more Sega games for a while. And of course, I just finished Shenmue 2. So I'll be going into Shenmue 3 actually tomorrow. But I think what's great is that I get to sit down, play these games, and I love the games myself. I'm actually a big fan. So I get to play these games that I love and then hang out with people. You know, people ask me questions. People come on, say, hey. People are like, I'm so happy to see that you're streaming. I used to play this game when I was a kid. It makes me happy to see it again. And then they'll ask me stuff about, you know, same thing that you guys are asking me. You know, how is Yu Suzuki? How was it doing the voice or whatever? And it's cool. I get to do something that I love and hang out with the fans all the time. It's fantastic. I love it. It's really a lot of fun. I don't know if I expected that, but it's kind of like hanging out with a bunch of friends, because everybody so far has been so cool. You know, everybody has just been, you know, when they get on, they'll ask questions and all that stuff, but then we just start to talk about whatever. And we were talking about food and video games the other day, and what else? Sometimes just conversations get random, you know. A lot of times, yeah, it is about Shenmue, it is about voice acting. Somebody's like, oh, what do you, you know, what's a common, oh, what do you recommend for people who want to get into the voiceover business? I'll talk about that for a while. But then yeah, sometimes we're just talking about, oh, what's your gym workout routine or something like that, you know. So yeah, it's cool. I love it. It's great.
Random question, because we have Dan the Pizza Man here, and sometimes we ask this to our guests. Does pineapple go on pizza?
Wait, there's an end button right next to me real quick.
How about, I'll say that I don't put pineapple.
There we go.
Is that all right?
It's acceptable.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, I've talked about fusion food here. There's some crazy stuff that people put on their pizza. I mean, some pretty crazy stuff. And in Japan, too, they like to put crazy stuff on their pizza. You know, Japanese, they love to put mayonnaise on everything. They put
God, really? Mayonnaise on pizza?
Yeah, they put a big fried egg right in the middle of it. Yeah, just all kinds of weird, crazy stuff. Oh, they put fish flakes on it, too, you know? Just
oh, my Lord. Yeah, I thought I seen it all once I saw a Caesar salad on a pizza, but I didn't even know there was it expanded that far out. The mayonnaise and I've heard like the egg stuff, but it was more like a breakfast pizza. I didn't know they would just randomly just do it.
Yeah, yeah. They'll put all kinds of toppings on the pizza and then like a big old fried egg right in the middle.
Oh, wow.
Like, okay. All right. Whatever.
One of my good buddies, he's also a big Shenmue fan of the Gutter Nerds. He wanted me to ask you this. And also, I, on top of that, wanted to ask this question as well. Are there times when maybe you're drinking a soda or when it's time for bed, you just kind of bust out the Ryo Hazuki voice and you're just kind of like, ah, good. Or maybe when it's time for bed, you look at your watch and you're like, oh, wow, time for bed.
Right.
Anything like that. Right. Does that ever happen at all?
You know, it's funny. I will do the Coke. I will do the soda thing from time to time because that's like, and my daughter knows about it too. You know, she's watched me play Shenmue. She's played Shenmue herself. So yeah, I'll do the. Yeah. And they'll laugh at me.
Could you chug a coffee as fast as Ryo could chug a coffee?
Man, he drinks half of it in one go, look at it, and then chugs the rest. Wow, he's got to go though, you know, he's got revenge on his brain.
Whenever he's old enough, when he's 21, I wonder maybe he should enter in a beer drinking contest or something because.
True, man, he could slam that, pick a pitcher, beer, and just.
Yeah.
Das Boot.
He's slamming drinks down quick. I remember when I first played it, I was like, wow. I was excited because I could buy a soda in a video game, which I could never do in a video game. And he's just slamming them down.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, I mean, when you're jogging everywhere, you know, you got to keep up that energy. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I was in your stream one time and you did say the, good quote. You do have some.
Nice. You saw. It's funny. I haven't done that in a while, so you probably caught the last one.
You do have some one-liners, Corey. It's there are some great Shenmue one-liners that have come out of that game. So, it's great. It's great. One question I wanted to ask as well. You know, obviously with Shenmue 3, we waited 13 years later. It came out after 2. Uh-huh. Let's just say. That was it. There was no more Shenmue. There was no, let's say, unfortunately, Shenmue. There's no more Shenmue after the third game.
Yeah.
What would you want the community and the fans, what would you want the legacy of Shenmue to be if there was no more games after the third one?
Yeah. So what would I want the legacy to be? Yeah. That's a good question. If there are no more games, what do I want the legacy to be? You know, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about before, because we're not going to get a completion of the game, right? But I think Hazuki can be an inspiration to people. We talked about it before, right? The determination, the focus that he has. People could be inspired by that. They could say, I really want something. I really want... you know, I want a podcast, right? So, well, I mean, I need all these things. I need computers, microphone, I need whatever. So they can be laser focused on that. They could do something every day and then get something toward their goal every week or whatever that case, whatever that is for them, they can, you know, create, they could take those lessons that they've learned from Shenmue. Don't let anything get in your way. Be determined. Don't let anybody else tell you that you can't do it. And do what you want to do, you know, to get your podcast going, get your streaming going, whatever the case may be. And again, the other thing I talked about is family and friends. You know, I think people should learn those lessons. Those are some very important, or maybe, you know, the most important lesson in Shenmue. So I think people could, you know, just since we're not going to get a completion of the story, they could take those moments that we see that we've already gotten in Shenmue, and you could apply those things to your life. And I've been told that people have done that. They've changed their life because of Shenmue. People have said, I didn't know what I was going to do in life until I started playing Shenmue. And then I realized I want to design games. And then they started going to school for it. They changed their life. And now they're making games. Now they're, or even more, something that's really interesting. I remember people saying that they took a journey to Japan, and they went on the same route that Hazuki did. Started in Yokosuka, started going to different towns there in Japan, went over to Hong Kong, and then went out to more rural villages out in China, and realized that, you know, these kids don't have the same opportunities as some of the kids in the larger city. A gentleman decided to become a teacher there in China, actually lived and worked there in China, and decided to give an education to these children who wouldn't normally get the opportunity to experience something like that. They didn't have the ability to go to school because they didn't have a facility, they didn't have books, they didn't have people to do it. They would have just, you know, become farmers or whatever their destiny would have written for them already, but now they have the opportunity to do something else because of and it's so humbling that I can be a part of a game that has affected so many lives in so many ways, that somehow I was a part of something. You know, I was just a young kid at the time when I first did Shenmue, but I knew I was a part of a big, you know, game that was designed by Sega, and I was really excited by that, but I couldn't have imagined that it would have had such a profound effect on people. People have told me I was sick in bed, and the only thing that made me happy was playing Shenmue. So you brightened my life. Some people have had depression issues. Some people have had just large negative things in their life that somehow Shenmue was able to bring them out of that, was able to inspire them, was able to get them through whatever problems that they're having. And I was just a small part of that. You know, there's a whole team over in Sega, and of course Yu Suzuki is, you know, because of him we have Shenmue, but I'm so humbled that somehow I could be a part of something that has changed so many lives in such a positive way. And that's part of the legacy of Shenmue already. And I hope that we get more, so we could affect more lives, and we could get more story out there, and maybe some younger generation could experience some of that magic that that people have told me about throughout the years.
Yeah, man, that's great, man. I mean, it's really nice to hear those kind of stories and how games affect people's lives, because, you know, it's a pretty common thing. You know, games, you know, have a powerful message for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, too, because, you know, we get these things with TV series and movies and I think books, that happens a lot with books, that a book can have a profound effect on people. But I think the reason that video games does is because you are participating in it. It's a story that you get to unfold, that you get to dive into, that you get to, you know, and I made the analogy with books changing people's lives. Shenmue is like a good book where you leave your reality for a while. You step out of your living room and you kind of feel like you're there. You kind of feel like you're in the box. You feel like you're Hazuki. You're running around. You're doing things. You're opening up chores. You're talking to store owners. You're doing whatever. And then you go on your mission. You rescue Nozomi, or you know, you bust up some gangsters, and you leave. I kind of feel that's how I felt when I was playing Shenmue for the first time. I kind of just was like, oh yeah, I'm back. Oh, I'm in reality. I forgot about this for a second. I feel because Shenmue does put you into a different headspace for a while, that's how I compare it to a good book. Because if you sit down with something, you can't stop turning the pages. It's you forget what time it is, you know. So you might look up and be like, whoa man, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, I've been reading for whatever 12 hours or something. God, I can't believe it. So yeah, Shenmue is kind of like that. You know, sometimes you'll be playing for hours and hours and hours. Okay, I gotta get up for work in the morning, so I should probably turn this off now. I think that's probably why it's had so much effect on people, because games do that a lot nowadays because they're so immersive. They're so Shenmue is one of those games that is the base of the pillar. You know what I mean? And everything else is built up on top of that. All these games that we love and know today, we talked about Breath of the Wild. You know, it could be any. It could be Red Dead. It could be God of War. You know, there's these big open worlds nowadays because of Shenmue. So Shenmue is like one of the. There's several pillars, and Shenmue is one of the bases of that pillar. And all of these great games that we know and love today is because of Shenmue. You know, so yeah, all of these games that are so immersive, that make us lose time, that make us feel like we went on these adventures, mm-hmm. to make us feel like we rescued the princess, to make us feel like we jumped into that raging river, to make us feel like we were the ones scaling those buildings in London or whatever the case may be. You know, you're discovering secrets. You're busting up bad guys, whatever the case may be. You almost feel like you're there from time to time, and it's getting crazier now. Virtual reality and everything else.
Yeah. VR, we'll get into it. You mentioned how games have like helped people and stuff like that. I will say that one game that came out in 2020 that definitely will go into history of, you know, definitely helping people. Obviously, was during when COVID really hit really bad. Was Animal Crossing.
You know,
Animal Crossing came out at a time where everyone was quarantined. There was nothing to do. And mm-hmm. Animal Crossing New Horizons comes around, and there was people I was seeing, and that was bringing people together. It was bringing joy because, you know, there was, you know, all this that was going on. And I even heard of people that have never played video games before in their life go get a Switch and get Animal Crossing. Yeah. And it was just bringing, it was a joyful thing when that game came out, because it was bringing people together, you know, and it was one of those games where it was just laid back, and you're building an island, and you know, you're building a community of the animals and stuff like that. So I think that game will go, you know, and who knows if it'll go down history, but I think that game is a staple of, you know, people who are going through, you know, whether it be depression or anything like that, I think has, you know, helped people.
And I think it should. I think it should go down in history. I find it fascinating that it doesn't have to be hyper realistic in order for it to be, you know, a popular game. It doesn't have to be super dynamic with its controls, or, you know, it can be something nice and simple. It can have cute characters. It can have nice melodies, you know, stuff that you just want to chill to, you know, like you said, you're building houses, you're building an island, you're cleaning up the beach, you're collecting fossils, you're right?
Paying down that loan.
Paying off the loan. Yeah, that's the best one.
Exactly. Oh, my outstanding loan. I finally got enough bells or whatever.
Tom Nook.
Yeah. Tom Nook's not going to. I remember the first game, he used to chase you around, right? I say I never played the first one, but I remember he used to chase you around asking for his loan. He doesn't do that nowadays, but.
The very first one I played was on GameCube, and yeah, he was
GameCube.
He was more like walking around town, like where's my loan shark that he is? Where's my damn loan?
Kneecaps if you don't. Where's my money? But you know, Animal Crossing, talk about a game that has brought people together. You're right. People have had weddings on Animal Crossing. People have had the best thing, which is a wedding, right? Or baby shower. Those are some of the best things. People have had some of the saddest things too. People have actually had funerals on Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
Everything from family get-togethers to classrooms. I've seen classrooms with Animal Crossing.
I celebrated New Year's with my villagers in Animal Crossing. They had, you know, I we were, you know, holidays of course were different. So Animal Crossing, you know, you celebrated the holidays through Animal Crossing, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, or, you know, Hanukkah, and, you know, and New Year's. I mean, it was just, again, I agree that it definitely should go down as that game that, when COVID hit,
really defined where we were in gaming in 2020, for sure.
Yeah.
So jumping a little bit back into topic, but more of a fun question here. You know, besides Shenmue, is there any other games that you would have loved to do some voice acting for?
Love to do voice acting for? Yeah, there's a lot of great games out there. God, where do I even start? Man, I don't know. I mean,
would you have loved to have done the voice on Resident Evil 1? If you had
that's yeah. So I remember playing Resident Evil 1, and of course it was a great game, but you know, yeah. So
funny that you bring that up.
So Shenmue is known for its quirky voice acting from time to time, and so yeah, I don't know. See, Resident Evil really did start its own legacy in a way, though, didn't it?
Yeah.
So I mean, would I have hated to be part of the first Resident Evil? Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I would have liked to have heard you say you almost turned into a Jill sandwich. I think that would have been
yeah. So it would have been a completely different character, though. Yeah, yeah. It would have been more obviously. I would have tried to make it more. It's its own thing, though.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's in its own realm of how, and I like in the remake of Resident Evil, they kind of made fun of themselves for the voice acting job. You know, the voice acting that went in the Resident Evil 1.
Yeah, well, you know, it was just a different world back then. They sometimes hired people who. You know, because I mean, I had different disciplines as well, right? Like, I wasn't a voice actor. I was basically a stage actor. I had done, like I said, I had done all kinds of stuff. I had been on TV and films before, but my main thing is stage acting, and that's real different. Stage acting is real different than voice acting, real different than acting on film, you know? In theater, you really have to be big and outrageous and sometimes over the top, and even when you're trying to be subtle and think about something internally, you still have to, you know, you have to emote. You still have to project your voice. I mean, somehow whisper to, you know, somebody your secret plans, but make sure that the person in the back of the audience can still hear you, you know. So it's completely different game. So yeah, I don't know, they hired people who, you know, maybe they had other things that they did in life and they had never done voice acting before, or maybe they didn't even hire professionals at all. And I mean that kind of happened to us too in Shenmue 1 and 2 in Japan. We had a whole myriad of voice actors, but each voice actor is doing like 10, you know, 12 different voices. But it's like, okay, maybe we need to get some other people in here. And they started to find people. They just started to find actors, or not actors. They just started to find people who were, I guess, native speakers. And this is workers. This is people who were there. Some people were in the, like some people were from the base, like there are military people that they asked to come in and do some of the voices. And sometimes it's just like, oh, you speak English? You want to be in a video game? You know, so that's kind of some of the, I would say some of the quirky voice acting that we got in Shenmue 1 and 2 as well. It's just like we had basically all of the best professionals. I mean, we talk about people like, you know, Paul Lucas and Eric Kelso and Liesl Wilkerson and all those people. They're like all professionals. They had done Sega games before. They do everything. They do everything from the voice that you hear in the train when the door's opening and closing to, you know, Virtua Fighter or something. We had all of those people in Shenmue, and then we had, I know they just kind of had to scrounge around and find as many native speakers as they possibly could. You know?
All right. So Shenmue just finished, you know, brand new copy just came out. you popped it in your console and your first time playing it, how did it feel to hear your voice? Oh, look, that's me. You know, how did that feel?
Yeah. And Shenmue 1. So, yeah, I did have that moment, you know, of like, oh yeah, that's great. That's great to know that that's me, that I did it, that I was a part of this. I guess you could say I did have that moment of happiness, of pride, you know. But then I just started playing the game. Because yeah, I love the game. I think it's fun, and I just started playing it, and I kind of forgot about it, you know. And I think you're talking about some of the famous one-liners. Of course, I think about it then. When I'm drinking soda, I think about it then. But yeah, most of the time, I think I'm just enjoying the game. You know, I'm just the pleasure of what Shenmue is. So the first times, you know, firing it up and hearing that, it was cool. And of course, you get the Shenmue 1, you get that that famous scene at the very beginning. Probably not going to ruin it for anybody who hasn't played it before, but yeah, at the very beginning of the story, traumatic events happen. So that there's that big scene at the very beginning that, yeah, I got to hear myself. And yeah, I'm just watching it like a cinema. I'm not having to play that part.
One question here before we get to our final question. What was your favorite task to do in Shenmue, like job or chore? I'm not gonna include the forklifts because I know everybody loved the forklift.
Yeah. Forklift races, right?
Awesome. Oh my God, everyone loved the forklift. Was it carrying books in Shenmue 2? Was it in Shenmue 3 chopping wood? Shenmue 2, or the I think you got to chase ducks in Shenmue 2.
Right,
or
right.
Shenmue 3, you were chasing chickens. What was
racing the ducks in
Racing the ducks, I'm sorry. Yes, you're racing
catching the chickens in Shenmue 3. You know, actually, it's funny. You brought up wood chopping. I think wood chopping is probably the most fun. I know some people go on to Shenmue and like fish all day. They just like, oh, I did nothing but fish all day today. I like fished for 4 hours. It's like, really? That's all you did in Shenmue today? Is that you just went fishing? You know? But yeah, as far as tasks, yeah, I think chopping wood. I don't know why. It feels so cathartic, right? You're lining it up and you just smash it, and you know.
Yeah, the books. Thank goodness Yu Suzuki took out the books in Shenmue 3, because those books drove me crazy. I was like, why do I have to? And it was like, it was a time, I think you woke up at like 8, and then you're there at like 9 or 10, and you're not done to 11. I'm like, man, I could have asked around town. I could have went gambling. Like, I'm here freaking carrying. When I was younger, I used to just purposely drop the books and fail because I just couldn't take it. I dropped everything. And I was like, I need to get out of here. But then as I got older, I was like, wait a minute, they give you move scrolls.
Right.
So exactly. Let me actually do this. So
right.
Get the move scrolls. So, you know, me being a young rage quitter back then, I dropped the books.
And as you earned your name, rage quit.
Yeah. And I learned my discipline. I like you say in the game, you learn discipline. I learned my discipline. I was like, let me carry these books and let me get my move scrolls.
Discipline, patience, right?
Yes.
You learn the value of doing something that you don't necessarily like to do. But then, like you said, you get that scroll, you get that prize, you get that new move. And then you go and you try it out and you're like, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. But when I was younger, I didn't know any better. And I was just like, screw these damn books. Out of the hell, I don't care about them.
Yeah. So, same thing with me. You know what I mean? Being young myself, I mean, I was like in my 20s, right? So yeah, being young myself, it's like, oh man, we really got to do this. We really got to do these books. I got to run home every day. You know, it's like, I got to run home and then go to sleep. That's kind of crazy. But that's all part of Shenmue, right? It teaches you, you know, it's not exact time, but it tells you about time. Not every store is open up at 7 a.m. Oh, some of them open up at 10. Oh, shit. Well, what do I do? Okay, well, I could go, like you said, go earn some money. I could go carry some boxes in Shenmue 2, right? Earn some cash. Or I could, like you said, gambling or something like that. I got to go do something. How about a game of Lucky Hit?
I love
that. Like, oh, okay. Now it's 10 o'clock. Now we can go to the barber shop or whatever the case is. So.
I I've seen some of the tricks, Corey, in your streams with Shenmue. You were saving the game and then reloading it to make sure you win.
Oh, man. I blame that on Korolik. So Adam Korolik was like, oh, man, what are you doing? Why are you carrying boxes? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, just go gamble. And I'm like, yeah, man, but I'm just, you know, you're going to lose the money. It's like, no, this is what you do. He told me to go to warehouse number 10 because that's where you can bet like $800 or something. You can max out. Was it 800? No, there's 800 over in Kowloon. I think over there is 400. You can max out at 400. And he's like, this is what you do. Just save. Okay, yeah. Save. All right, now there's no strategy. Just you win or you lose. And if you lose, you reboot. And if you win, then you save. And I was like, oh, damn. Like, oh, so this is like dark side. This is like some Sith move here. And he's like, oh.
That's what I had to do in Shenmue 3, by the way. So be prepared to do that again in Shenmue 3.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. In fact, I started doing it again. I think it was in Kowloon. I found that. I think it's just roll it on top where you can max out at 800. And I was like, 800? Oh, man, I'm doing the dark side Hazuki right now. Here we go. Save. Max out. Save again. And I ended up finishing the game with like $4,000 or something. So
we, Corey, we actually do have a question here in our chat from Sailor Moon.
Sailor Moon's in the chat?
Yeah, excellent. We have Sailor Moon _147. And the question is, if there was anything that you could change about the story, what would you change about the story if you could, if there's anything that you would change?
Oh, well, I mean, I think the only thing I wish I could change about the story is that we could have stayed on track between Shenmue 2 and Shenmue 3. I've talked about this a little bit before, but I feel that Shenmue 3 is like the bridge to get us back on track. Shenmue 3 is the game that we play that gets us along in the story, right? We progress a bit more on the story, but I know that there was probably things that needed to happen that we didn't get a chance to experience. So that's fine. That gets us to Shenmue 4. Of course, we had this big gap between 2 and 3. I wish that we were able to continue that, because all of these wonderful things that I've talked about, all the great stuff that Yu Suzuki has in mind, I want him to be able to get that out, to express that to all of us. So the only thing I wish that would happen is that, you know, 2 years later, we would have Shenmue 3, and then 2 more years, we'd have Shenmue 4, you know, but we had this big, long gap. We were able to do an awesome Kickstarter. We broke all those records for Kickstarter, and now we got Shenmue 3, which is like this great continuation. But now it's like, well, what else? You know, it's like those things that we've been thinking about all that time. Well, what is, you know, what's going on with Landy and all of his all the other members that we are finding out about? What's going on with the mirrors? What's the sword of the seven stars? Like, what's going on there? Those things that we all had all these questions to. I just like, oh man, I know that we're going to be able to get answers to these questions in Shenmue 4 and maybe even 5, you know. So that's the only thing that I wish is that, I think we all wish that, yeah, 2 years after Shenmue 2 that we got 3 and we were able to continue how we wanted to. We wanted to, you know, get all the story just right. I know that I've seen sort of basic storyline from 1 to beyond, and I remember seeing the chapters and how the games were supposed to be chaptered out. So it's like, yeah, you know, we did the best that we could with the Kickstarter, and I think we got a great game out of it. It was so beautiful. We were able to continue those stories. We got to experience a Bailu village. We spent time with Shenhua, but it's like those big questions that we had at the end of 2, we didn't get a chance to experience that as much as I think a lot of fans and me and, you know, and everybody else wanted to. We wanted to get some of those answers. So it's like, oh, I can't wait for 4 and beyond. We'll see.
Yeah, the hope for me as a huge fan is that maybe this opens the eyes of Sega, and they kind of maybe jump back in, because as much as I love Shenmue 3, a part of me as a huge fan was missing a little bit with Sega not being there.
Not being a part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and Sega not being a part of it. So hopefully this opens their eyes with, you know, how great Shenmue did in Kickstarter. Yeah. And everything like that, and hope that, you know, fingers crossed, I want a Shenmue 4, that whenever we do get a Shenmue 4, that they're, you know, back in the fold. Yeah. But, you know, fingers crossed.
Yeah. A lot of people have expressed the exact same thing, you know. That would be fascinating if Sega decided to throw their hat back in the ring. You know, that would really bring a lot of strength, you know, a lot of power back into the ability to tell the story, you know. But it's interesting. Exactly. Right? We want more Sonic capsules. You know, the thing is that there was a lot of so we got other companies involved, you know, Deep Silver, and we learned some lessons through just distribution. Like, it didn't sell so well over here, but it sold amazing over here. I mean, like, for example, it didn't sell so well in Japan, which was a little bit surprising for people, and for some people anyway. And then, like, it sold really, really well over in Europe, and particularly in the UK. I had a lot of UK fans tell me, like, we can't even get it here. Like, we're oh, wow, that's every crazy. every time it comes out on the shelves, they're gone. And there's like, we can't even get it on Amazon. Amazon UK was completely sold out, and they had to wait for it to come. I was like, wow, that's awesome, great, you know. So I think we learned some valuable lessons there too. So I think we take all those lessons, and there's all that money that's been infused from the companies that got involved with Shenmue 3. And man, I mean, if Sega comes back, and that would be quite a powerhouse. We would get a fantastic game. I think Yu Suzuki would be able to do anything he wants with all those teammates, you know.
Yeah, fingers crossed for the future for Shenmue. You know, it was painful. I would talk about it all the time. Like, my gosh, everyone would ask me, what's the one game you're excited for? Shenmue 3. It's never coming out. I'm like, yes, it is. It's going to come out.
It's never going to come out. Yes. Yes, it is. You know, it's funny. I always say that the fans really did just keep it alive no matter what. I still say to this day that the fans are what got Shenmue 3 made. You know, if Yu Suzuki... Think about it, you know, Yu Suzuki, that's his big passion in life. But, you know, if it didn't work out, somebody like him's got to move on. You know, he's got like, okay, well, let's make other great games. I have other really great ideas. I have, you know, I got a job to do. so he's gonna move on and make other amazing projects. But you know, for his entire life, that he's always been dogged by Shenmue. People were always asking about Shenmue. All the fans all over the world. You know, I mean, like, when he decided to make his own company, do you think how easy would it for Yu Suzuki to come out with a game that is simple to make, a fighting game, a racing game, some stuff that he's done before, and then just make tons of money off of it? You know, how easy would it be to make a game that's relatively simple development wise, and then they could just sell tons and tons of copies? That would be a piece of cake. You could definitely do that. But he decided to do Shenmue 3. Of course, it's his passion project. I've talked about that before, but you know that nobody would ever leave him alone, ever. You or all the fans or anybody. It's like, I'm sure that's all he hears all day long. Shenmue. When's Shenmue 3 going to come out? When are you going to do Shenmue? Come on, why don't you, you know, it's, and fans just go nuts whenever any like picture or anything gets released. I remember one time I was in Vegas and there was a, what's that?
Were you playing Lucky Hit?
Well, check this out. I was going along in one of the hotels, and they had a big arcade there. I was like, ooh, this is cool. I went in there, and of course they had a bunch of Sega games, because Sega makes awesome arcade games. And there was, man, what I don't remember what it was. What game was it? I don't remember what it was. But of course, they had a big Sega on the side. And I just decided to take a picture, you know, with my hand like this and Sega right over here. And I was like, yeah, Sega. And I put that out on my Facebook and everybody just went nuts. Like the internet exploded. Everybody melted down. Everybody thought that I was in Japan. They was like, Shenmue 3 confirmed. Shenmue 3's coming. Look, there's a Sega sign right next to him. And I was like, oh no. Oh man, I forgot. I didn't put any context. Oh, that was dumb. I freaking everybody out. So stuff like that, I'm sure would happen all the time. And so Yu Suzuki just, I know that he had to get it done, not only for himself, but of course for everybody else out there, all the fans.
Well, all right. So as we, you know, get closer to the end of our podcast, we usually like to ask a question to, you know, our guest, which I'm assuming you answer this question quite a bit. But the question is, what's the best advice that you can give to somebody who would want to, you know, start voice acting?
Yeah. So this is the answer that I give. And I think I really hope that people take this to heart, is that voice acting is not about like doing character voices. You have to be an actor first. Right? Like I always say to people, like, look, I'm going to use something that everybody knows, like, so you can do a really great Stewie impression, you know, but that's not going to help you get a job. You know, you can do an impression, but then let's just say you get a whole script, you go in that day and you can do an impression of this character or that character, but then you have a script on top of that. So how are you going to do that impression with all the different words that you know, give us the story? So it's not, voice acting is not like, oh, I got, you know, 20 different voices that I can do. You have to be an actor first. So you got to do all the actor things, you know, like you got to take classes, you know, you got to hone your skills. You can work on your impressions. Of course, do those things. But you have that character, but you have to be really angry that day, or you have to be really sad. Something terrible has happened. Your father has died, or your kingdom has been destroyed, or you've killed your father and you've married your mother. So you're having a, you know, an Oedipus moment. So you're
enjoying that. That analogy.
You broke me that one.
And if you can imagine all of that in a Stewie voice, that's what you got to do that day.
I'm sorry, Corey. You broke me on that one.
Yeah, do all of that in Stewie's voice, and then you can be a voice actor. No, seriously, you know what I'm saying, though, right? Like, bad things happen or happy things happen. You got to be in love. You got to hate somebody over here. You got to have a rivalry over there. You know what I mean? So you have to be an actor first before you can just like, oh, I could do some silly voices. Okay, cool. I got a project for you. Come on over. No, it's not like that. It's you know, you have to audition, you have to take your classes, you got to get your audition reel together. And so that's actually something I'm going to do right after COVID, is get my new reel together, so I can send those in for auditions and people can hear my voice doing whatever. if I'm narrating, or if I'm fighting, or if I'm, you know, just being Oedipus, or but yeah, that's what I recommend. Like, seriously, you got to do all of the actor things to be a voice actor. It's not just one thing. Well, let me put it this way, like, voice acting is like mixed martial arts. If you go into an MMA cage only doing boxing and that's it, you're gonna lose. You know what I mean? You don't know how to kick. You don't know how to grapple. You don't know how to do any judo. You don't know how to do any jujitsu. The fight's going to be over. Fight's going to be over in seconds. Think of yourself like that. Like, if you do impressions, all you're doing is boxing. which is great if you're in a boxing ring and you got big gloves on and you're standing in a ring and you're fighting another guy with gloves on. But if you're fighting, you know, if you're fighting anybody who has mixed skills, then the fight's over seconds. It's the fight's over in seconds. So think of acting as like that. You have to have different acting skills, just like a mixed martial artist has to have stand-up skill, ground skill. You know, he has to be able to do, I mean, you know, we talk, everybody knows you have to do jiu-jitsu, you have to do judo, you have to do wrestling, you have to do boxing, you have to do kickboxing, you have to do you know, and it's great to see some more traditional martial arts as well. I'm seeing kicks from karate, I'm seeing kicks from Thai boxing, like taekwondo kicks as well. It's like you have to be able to have all of that vocabulary in order to defeat an opponent who's just as skilled. Think about going to an audition and this guy's got his skills, but you have to have a better skill than him. You have to be able to defeat him in the ring of jobs. You know what I mean? Like you have to have more skill in multiple areas than this guy does. And if you have more skill, then you'll get the job.
Really quickly, before we end out here, you mentioned that you're a big you're a fan of MMA. Do you watch UFC at all?
Well, not recently. there are some people who do excite me.
Are you gonna watch McGregor Poirier tomorrow?
Yeah, I don't know. I've seen McGregor before. You know what I mean? I like people who are interesting. McGregor is definitely interesting. He's got a different stance. He has a different posture. I like how he's almost got this traditional. You've seen those old man, those old standing fights where the boxers are standing up very erect and they have their fists in a kind of a, he fights like that, where he almost has one hand out as a lead hand. And I've seen a lot of fighters do this recently where they test with that lead hand. And it almost looks like those old timey boxers, you know, where they have one hand forward and one hand back like this, and they have that upright posture. It, you know, McGregor kind of reminds me of that a little bit. I kind of see that. I'm like, whoa, that's kind of weird, but it really works for him. You know, he tests with that lead hand, and he's able to find his target that way, and really come in. He's got great skill. People like him interest me all the time, and I wouldn't mind seeing that fight. But another thing too I find fascinating is I used to watch a lot of women fight because I like their movement vocabulary, because
there's some really good like Amanda Nunes, and
she's great.
There's some really good women MMA fighters. Rose Namajunas is another one that is
awesome.
Very good. Joanna Jędrzejczyk, who was really good. She still is really good, but when she was champion, dominant, you know, Ronda Rousey, of course, Miesha Tate, you know, there's a long list.
Yeah. You know why I like watching them is because they do have, I think, a larger vocabulary when it comes to fighting. Oh, yeah. Have mommy check the email. So they, you know, I mean, let's just take Ronda Rousey when she was, we won't get into what happened to her afterwards, but when she was still using a lot of her judo and all that, I was really excited to watch her fight, you know, Tate, like you said, Nunes, all these people. Where I was going with my statement is that I like to watch women because they do so many different things, you know. They stand up, strike. They use their kicks. They use their grappling. It's not like, I noticed that a lot of men tend to get into a rut when it comes into their stand up fight, for example. That's why I like to see dynamic fighters who like to try different things. And you know, everybody talks about when some of these more traditional kicks make knockouts, when somebody does a roundhouse or somebody does a front kick to the face and knocks the guy out, and everybody's like, whoa, where'd that come from? And I'm like, man, you know, we've been doing that forever. It's like when I spar with my friends, I get them all the time with a front kick. It's front kick to the body is real popular. You end up doing a push kick, you get them off of you set them up, and then you can you get your distance back, all that stuff. But then it's like, you know, front kicking somebody to the jaw, man, that's like almost instant knockout, yeah. You know? And there's a lot of moves that in the UFC nowadays we're not allowed to use because they say, you know, it's for safety reasons. I think a lot of it's a little bit BS, but there's a lot of, when I see people using larger moves. I mean, you see it. I mean, if you watch a lot of Thai fighting, you watch a lot of these guys in Thailand fighting. Man, they're like the way that they're able to slip in with their, you know, how they're faking their kicks, and when it appears that they're going in for a leg kick or something, they're able to whip up their knee and knock somebody straight across the jaw, you know. Those types of techniques that we don't get to see very much in the UFC, those things I really love and enjoy. And we used to see that a lot in some of the older UFC when there are, you know, less rules. But I think that a lot of people get into a rut sometimes, and I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but
no, sorry.
Let me put it this way. I don't like to see a lot of brawling. You know, I don't like to see brawlers in the UFC. I like to see fighters, you know, I like to see chess players. And you see a lot of these champions really are chess players. You know, they really do have a lot of different tools that they can pull from in their toolbox to take care of different problems. This guy's got, when he leads with his right, he always drops his chin, you know, so I'm going to do a round kick to the face or something, you know, those types of things. I love to see people thinking. I love to see people making decisions based on the opponent's move, seeing their weaknesses and applying the correct move to deal with those problems. And, you know, a lot of those things can, if the guys you see more traditional Thai boxing and stuff like that, those things I really enjoy. So I don't know. There's a lot to be. I could go on for days about UFC. Maybe we should. maybe we should move on.
one last thing, Corey. Somebody hears your voice and they want to say hello. I thought this would be a perfect time for them to say hello.
Yeah.
See the camera.
Yeah.
Say hi.
Oh, hey. Who's this?
I thought it'd be perfect to bring a cat here to say hello.
Hello, is this Mimi? Is this Chibi? Who is this?
It's Tuxedo, but he heard your voice and he's like, I need some milk now.
But some milk.
We're gonna go ahead and wrap up the podcast here. We just want to say here at In Her Mom's Basement, thank you so much, Corey, for taking the time to join us here. It's been really awesome to meet you. And again, as a, you know, as I told you before, when we first chatted, when I was 10 years old playing Shenmue, if somebody was like, oh, do you think you'll ever interview Corey Marshall? I'd be like, oh no, you're crazy. But thank you so much.
Here we are.
Yeah, here we are. Here we are.
You made it happen, man. You manifested that destiny. You got that laser focus. You got that Hazuki focus. You got your podcast, and yeah, here we are, man.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, awesome. And thank you so much again, Corey. Really, really appreciate it, guys. You can listen to this podcast on all podcast platforms, on Spotify, Google, iTunes, innermomsbasement.com. And Corey, did you want to tell our audience as well where they can find you, your Twitter and your Twitch?
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, listen, I wanted to say, first of all, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. You know, it's been a lot of fun. I'm happy that you brought me on for your first here in 2021. But I also wanted to thank all the fans out there too for being so awesome. I mean, honestly, we got Shenmue because of you guys. I really honestly believe that. So I want to thank all the fans out there for everything they do for me and my family and the industry and buying the games. We don't have jobs without all the fans out there. You know, we just be like weirdos talking in a sound booth to nobody if it wasn't for you guys. So, but yeah, you can find me, Corey Marshall, VoiceOver Pro. Or Corey Marshall VO Pro. You can find me on Twitter. And yeah, check me out on Twitch. I'll be streaming. You can find me Corey Marshall, VoiceOver Pro, or check me out on Twitter. I always put my little my Twitch URL there, so you guys can just click on that. But yeah, I'll be streaming Shenmue 3 for the first time tomorrow, Saturday, 10 a.m. Los Angeles time.
Awesome. Again, thank you so much, Corey. It's been an honor to have you here. Again, guys, you can go all of our socials in our mom's basement as well. And you can listen to this podcast on all podcasting platforms. And for our live audience, thank you guys for coming to hang out. We really appreciate it. And, happy new year to everybody. This was our first podcast of 2021. We were joined by Corey Marshall, the voice of Ryo Hazuki. And definitely go check out his channel as well. It's an awesome, awesome, awesome time. He does answer a lot of questions on there. But again, thank you guys so much. I'm Rage Quit Pat. That is Dan the Pizza Man.
Yes.
And everybody, take care.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night.
You've just listened to the In Our Mom's Basement, a video game podcast with your hosts, Dan Geoffwe and Rage Quit Pat. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Google Play. See you in the next episode.